Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Angeli. This half hour on the program, we'll talk about U.S. strategy toward Afghanistan and policy toward Afghanistan and toward Pakistan. We'll also find out what life is like for the people of Afghanistan in the capital city of Kabul and the villages and provinces, some of which now controlled effectively by the Taliban. A first-hand look with my guest. Alam Payind is director of Ohio State University's Middle East Studies Center. He grew up in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in the mid-1970s, in fact, for the Afghanistan government, he was director general of cultural and foreign relations. Also in the early 1960s, personal note, he was a captain of the Afghan national soccer team at that point, and he has a bachelor's degree from Kabul University, the university in the capital city. Welcome back, Alam Payind. Great to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Alam, I can't imagine what life must be like for people in Afghanistan now. Just on April 28th, there was supposed to be a rather controversial celebration known informally as Mujahideen Day to celebrate in Kabul, the capital, the victory over the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union was driven out of Afghanistan. But they had to cancel the celebration because they could not provide security. So I wonder what life must be like for an ordinary person in the capital, Kabul, just as one example.
Yeah, I think the security is deteriorating not only in Kabul, but almost all provinces. It's true that it used to be a celebration. They were holding it each year since the Soviets left Afghanistan in February of 1989. But this year they couldn't do it because of security reasons. In the first 3 months of this year, suicidal attacks and roadside bombs and all other insurgency attacks have increased by 72% over the last year, year's three first months of the last years. So this is the deterioration of the security situations in Afghanistan.
Also, in terms of women's rights, we hear that the Taliban have been burning girls' schools. We hear, although Radio Free Europe noted that in the past year, some 11,000 schools have reopened in Afghanistan, despite more than 200 school-related terrorist attacks. But again, according to Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is a United States outlet, about 5 million children are not going to school in Afghanistan for various reasons.
Yes, that's true. So there are improvements. Schools have reopened, 1,100 and so on, but about 200 were burned last year. So that's another side of the story.
By Taliban?
By Taliban. Mm-hmm. And it's true that 5 million students now go to schools, but 5 million more are not going to schools because of lack of money and schools and buildings and teachers. And so there are deficiencies that the Afghan government cannot really catch up with the demand.
And the Taliban would prefer that girls not go to school at all, I imagine.
Yes, it is true that most of the conservative groups in Afghanistan, they do not want. The main reason is that there is no security. And when girls become the target of girls and boys, both, all of them. So security is the major reason. And people do not want to send their kids to schools because they are afraid that schools might be burned and blown up and children may be kidnapped. So it's that sort of fear in the the minds of the parents that they do not want to send them. And also there is this dire poverty. The child labor is important. 8-year or 9-year-old child is supposed to really either do shepherding in the countryside or work in the farm with the parents. So it's a child labor is also important.
So, and of course, Taliban, I guess, ideologically don't want girls to go to school.
Yes, they thought that this is modern school system. Is not. It's just taking, especially girls, from the daily chores, and also they are teaching them Western values and something which is against the Islam. Which again, it's not really correct. The difficulty is
that's just the Taliban interpretation.
It's a Taliban interpretation of Islam. Yes, and this is one reason that we do not see Muslim scholars, which are called ulama, among the ranks of the Taliban. They're really Most of the Taliban are uneducated or with some rudimentary knowledge of Islam. Mm-hmm. So the Muslim scholars are against what the Taliban are doing, are the educated Muslims, I should say.
Sure. In the southern provinces, I guess the Taliban seems to, at least according to some Western news reports, seems to hold sway in some of those provinces that they Sarah Chase, who used to report for National Public Radio, but now she has a nonprofit organization helping people, a small cooperative in Afghanistan, says that people are caught between the Taliban, who threaten them, and a very corrupt government, and the corruption, she says, translates down to even local transactions with local officials and with police.
She's absolutely right. She's right. She is in Kandahar. She was situated there, and she's one of the few Americans that who really see things from a close range. Taliban are not controlling areas. This is insurgency. They mm-hmm. go and they intimidate people in the night. The government does not have the security. It's the weakness of the government. It's not the strength of Taliban. So if any one of those local people who are cooperating or collaborating with the government, the next day they find themselves in deep trouble, either their children or themselves. So it's the fear of the Taliban which is working against the security. They are not controlling territories. They are not collecting taxes. They don't have planes. They don't have helicopters. They don't mm-hmm. have armored personnel carriers. But the intimidation is there because the government does not have the control. And also in the southern cities or provinces of Afghanistan, in those areas which are bordering Pakistan, it's either the Canadians or the British troops. So there are a few Americans. Now, with the 21,000 more troops sent President Obama's administration has taken authority mm-hmm. there. So there will be 21,000 more sent. So some of these American troops will go to the Kandahar and Helmand and Zabul areas. They might secure some of the territories.
It sounds like a really tragic situation for the people of Afghanistan. I mean, threatened on the one hand in some cases by the Taliban, a corrupt government that is preying upon them, a security situation that doesn't allow kids to go to school. Pretty awful.
Yes, it is. To begin with, Afghanistan is not a very rich country. It does not have petroleum. It does not have very big, huge farms. Some of even the rich farmers will have about 50, 60 acres of land. And the terrain is not very conducive for irrigation and agriculture. Mm-hmm. It's very mountainous. And so that economic base is so weak that it cannot sustain, let's say, 180,000 army and about 180,000 police and schools and teachers. So the money has to come from outside, so it cannot generate. And this is one reason why the poppy production is increasing in that country in the absence of other kind of livelihood for the people.
So a farmer is looking around to see how, or a villager looking around to see how they can make a living, and they say, well, if I grow opium poppies, that's a crop that I can count on selling.
Yes. Yeah. If a farmer has about 1,500 acres of irrigated land, and 1 acre of that will bring as much cash as other 14 acres. So, and also that will be less labor intensive. And if they can get away with this and sell this opium to the drug traffickers and the middlemen and the processors, so that's one reason. It's the lack of security has caused this opium, the poppy production in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. And so we read reports that poppy production is up to the point where it was prior even to the Taliban. In other words, that its full acreage is being devoted to this, and big criminal gangs are buying up the opium poppies.
Yes, it's not only the domestic criminal gangs. It's the international mafia is involved too. It's mm-hmm. a big, huge chain of these traffickers that which goes to the farmers and give them money in advance and tell them to cultivate poppies. And the farmer is getting very small amount of money. It's mostly the processors and the middlemen and the traffickers. And when they do convert raw opium into sort of heroin, and then it has to go through some sort of chemical process. And then when it hits the markets in Europe and the United States, and the price can go about maybe 500 to 1,000 times what they pay to the farmers. So it could be dealt with from at the beginning. some sort of subsidy policing, and also interdictions. So it's not happening. As of yet, the drug problem have not been addressed by either the International Security Assistance Forces or NATO or American, because the main focus up to this time has been on capturing and defeating Al-Qaeda militarily. Now, recently, there will be a comprehensive plan, and we will see that what this comprehensive strategy would be.
Yeah. Alan Payen is director of Ohio State University's Middle East Studies Center. He grew up in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're at 614-292-8513 or email to openline at WOSU.org. Now we have President Hamid Karzai, who, according to Western reports, is not a very popular president, doesn't seem to be able to travel around the capital city, Kabul, without heavily armed guards. There have been more than one attempt on his life. Yet he's running for president in the election in about 4 months and is likely to win, apparently.
Yes. So I just recently heard that there are four other people that who have challenged him. There are many. Some people say that even 60 more people have challenged him, but four of them are really formidable challengers. One is a former minister of finance by the name of Ashraf Ghani, and another one is former minister of interior by the name of Jalali. And there is Abdullah Abdullah, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So these are the three. And also, I heard that Zalmay Khalilzad, the former American ambassador to Afghanistan, he's also considered by some, and there are some sort of demonstrations in his favor, supporting him.
Former American ambassador.
Former American. So he's an Afghan-born.
Yeah.
He was an Afghan-born Zalmay Khalilzad from the United States, and he was the first ambassador after October the 6th. And I should say that probably December of 2001, when the coalition forces went to Afghanistan and removed Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the power in Afghanistan. But Taliban and Al-Qaeda were not defeated.
No, apparently not.
Yeah. So they went to Pakistan, and then they found support there by different one of the groups that which supported the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan were the ISI, the Pakistani Interintelligence Services, and also the two other religious groups like Jamaat al-Islami and Jamaat al-Ulama'i Pakistan, and also the Pakistani Taliban. So those were removed from power in Afghanistan, but they went and found safe havens in Pakistan. And now the comprehensive strategy will address that. And
that's of the Obama administration.
Obama administration, yes.
Yeah. We hear, let's get your take, Alam, on strategy, because we hear all kinds of calls for various strategies, ranging from President Obama's comprehensive strategy, which involves, among other things, moving 20,000 troops to poppy-growing regions, announced the New York Times the other day, because these poppy growers are financing Taliban activities. So we hear everything from the comprehensive approach with more troops introduced into Afghanistan to others who say, you know, the United States has no real security interest in Afghanistan. We should leave. Our troops should simply leave. And others who say, well, we should stay out of humanitarian interest, but we should stay for no other reason than that. What's your take?
Well, I think, what we saw when the Soviets left Afghanistan in February 1989, and there was an agreement between the United States and the former Soviet Union that both of them will not support and not send weapons to Afghanistan, to their proxy groups, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it happened. So when the Soviet Union left, so Afghanistan was neglected and ignored and was not rebuilt. A central government was not established, and it became a failed state. And to that failed state went Al-Qaeda and others. So that's what then we heard September the 11th happened. If again Afghanistan will become a failed state, and we know that how failed states act and behave, Somalia is one of those, Rwanda was another, and Cambodia was at one point. So that is one thing that if they want to prevent another second time that Al-Qaeda will regroup in Afghanistan, so there is a threat coming from that. It's not the threat will not stay inside Afghanistan. It will go to the neighboring countries. So that's one important piece of the strategy, that Afghanistan has to be somehow stabilized. And second, Afghanistan could not be stabilized, could not be peaceful if Pakistan will not do more than it can do. Pakistan is a country which has about almost more than 500,000 soldiers, and it's not a failed state. And they can really unleash the Pakistani military on Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, I should say. But they have only sent about 6,000 or 7,000 Pakistani troops.
They have the power to unleash. They have half a million men in arms.
And the main question is that why Pakistan is not doing it? Mm-hmm. Because most of these insurgency, these Taliban, are in the Pashtun areas. They are Pashtuns. And Pashtuns have other grievances against the Punjabi-dominated government. And if Pakistan will unleash this military, which is predominantly a Punjabi military, on the Pashtuns, and Pashtuns will be slaughtered, there is a possibility of some sort of a bigger problem that the Pashtun areas and the Baloch areas and the Sindhis, which do not like the Punjabi domination. And that's the fear. They want to do it in a surgical fashion. But Pakistan has the capability. First of all, as I mentioned, the Pakistani Taliban do not have planes. They do not have fixed-wing planes. They do not have helicopters. They do not have tanks. They do not have armored personnel carriers. So it's not a threat to the Pakistani government. And Pakistan was not a failed state. It has a strong army and strong central government. But they, for other political reasons, they do not want to put a lot of pressure on the Taliban. Mm-hmm. But there is. The capability is there. They can do it.
It's interesting. President Obama, in his press conference last week, said that he did not fear that Pakistan's nuclear arms would fall into the hands of Taliban or other insurgents. But there's a report in the New York Times this morning saying that there is indeed a fear that should the government collapse in Pakistan, that those nuclear arms could indeed fall into the wrong hands. So we don't know what to believe at this point, I guess.
No, but there are other things. Taliban are not a big threat to the Pakistani central government. As I mentioned, that's more than 500,000 troops and garrisons in Pakistan.
Yeah.
Pakistan was not attacked by any foreign country. They had three wars with India. They consider India to be a bigger threat, an existential threat to Pakistan. And the Pakistani military doctrines are mostly it's focused on India as a bigger threat, and also they consider Afghanistan and the Pashtuns in the northwest frontier of Pakistan and the tribally administered agencies and areas as a sort of strategic depth for Pakistan against India. So these are these things in play. That's why the Pakistani government now, especially the military, do not want to unleash really the army against the Taliban. But I the way that I have studied Pakistan from a close range, Pakistani Taliban are not in a position to really defeat the Pakistani military, unless Punjabis will rise and Sindhis will rise and Baloch will rise and the Pashtuns will rise simultaneously.
So that's not likely.
That's not likely to happen, yes.
Yeah. Well, you know, President Obama has continued a policy that President Bush initiated of predator drone, the drone planes, their missile attacks in Pakistan along the Afghan border, targeting militants but also killing villagers. And we saw photos of one demonstration some weeks ago in Pakistan, you know, welcoming President Obama to the office of our presidency, but at the same time saying that his welcome for them was bombs. So how do Pakistanis regard these missile attacks by the United States?
Yes, there's the predators. They're not very precise. Pakistanis know about this and Afghans know. They are killing one or two or three Al-Qaeda or Taliban, but scores of other people in the villages are killed. And these Al-Qaeda and Taliban, especially I'm talking about the Pakistani Taliban here, not Afghan Taliban, they are just living in the midst of other people. So these drones are not that precise. It's indiscriminate in many ways. They are hitting the targets, but beside that, there are other innocent people killed. And that is creating or eroding the support among the common people against their own government and against Americans that they consider. And the same is true in Afghanistan. A wedding bombarded and...
A wedding.
So that sort of situation or some sort of gathering are false reports to some of the authorities, and they will give the coordinate and the planes come in 15, 20 minutes. And they bombard, and there is a possibility that a lot of civilians will be killed, innocent people.
And in fact, have been.
That's true. Hundreds and thousands have been killed, civilians in Afghanistan. And that's
how many would you put the number in Afghanistan?
But literally, in past year, 5,000 Afghans have been killed. Half of them Taliban. That's the statistic. No one has really accurate statistics.
Sure.
There are some sort of assumptions by scholars that who do the research. Of those 2,000 civilians, and half of them, which would be 25% of the 5,000, have been just innocent civilians killed in the villages. Yeah.
How could we stop that?
It could be stopped if there are more boots on the ground. I'm not talking about American and international security. The Afghan army should be increased to the level and given training to them and some sort of salaries that they will not be corrupt. So, I mean, these are all some sort of ifs there.
Mm-hmm.
If the Afghan army is developed to the level of 180,000 troops, these are the scholars and the experts that were analyzing,
yes,
that Afghanistan will need at least between 180,000 to 200,000 Afghan soldiers and about the same number as police, and they will be able to be in the front, on the ground, and supported by the trainers from International Security Assistant Forces or NATO, and they will take the fighting to the areas and secure the areas from the Taliban and establish some sort of security. And after that, there will be some sort of economic development or whatever, that they can really farm their farms and cultivate their farms. And then after that, there's some sort of, after the development, and then some sort of reconciliation with those Taliban,
mm-hmm,
that who are reconcilable.
Some are reconcilable.
Yeah, most of them are ideologically oriented and linked to the Al-Qaeda. Taliban are very few in Afghanistan. Many of them are just opportunists. They have taken the weapons because there is no other industry. In the absence of economic development and programs and other livelihood, so taking arms and fighting and getting some money, whether from the drug lords or warlords or others, so it has become some sort of industry and in jobs for people. Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds like, Alan, we just have about a minute and a half left. It sounds like long-term training in terms of Afghan security force, that this is a long-term project, that long-term involvement of both U.S. troops and international aid for Afghanistan. Would that be right, and are you optimistic?
I think that it could not be done in 2, 3, 5, 6. So probably it will be at least it will take 10 more years. And also there has to – money should come from somewhere, because Afghanistan's economy cannot generate this amount of money, whether it should come from the Gulf countries or from the United Nations or other – it will be international effort. Afghanistan cannot – neither can generate that amount of money to sustain an army and police or teachers and – mm-hmm, let's take to build capacity at the same time. So it's really it should be a long range plan. It could not be. I cannot perceive that it should be. I cannot assume that it will be in 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic that this plan can work?
I think if there is international will, that will help. If there will be international support, that will work. And also, it could not be done in any insurgency that we study in the history. There has to be some sort of reconciliation at the end. And without that, without diplomatic efforts, without political efforts, without economic efforts, militarily, it's very difficult to defeat an insurgency alone by military might.
Alam Payeen is director of Ohio State University's Middle East Studies Center. Alam, a great pleasure having you on the show all these years, and I thank you so much for coming back.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
All right, and when we come back, Columbus Dispatch columnist Joe Blundo at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Ask a teenage boy a question, and the reply will likely fall somewhere between laconic and terse, like James Dean's famous rebel teen.
You're tearing me apart!
Melina Saval looks beyond the archetypes to the fascinating inner lives of today's adolescent males. I'm Neil Conan, The Secret Lives of Boys. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That topic and much more on Talk of the Nation when it begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. And our spring membership drive begins on May 7th, but you can do your part right now to support WOSU and enter to win a custom-made pendant, courtesy of Jack Seibert Goldsmith Jewelers. Help inspire other WOSU listeners just like you. And make your gift online right now at WOSU.org. And thanks for your support.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group Financial Planners and Investment Consultants, helping clients achieve financial independence through professional planning at sherringtongroup.com.
We'll return to Open Line in just a moment. Currently 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today. Maybe a little bit of sunshine this afternoon. A slight chance of rain and a high of 65. Clouds this evening and cooler tonight with a low of 49. Some sunshine for Tuesday and a high of 70 degrees. And for Wednesday, rain is likely and a high of 72. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This half hour on the show, Columbus Dispatch columnist Joe Blundo on turning 55 years old and becoming therefore near elderly. We'll talk about the success of Susan Boyle, a member of the People Who Aren't a Beautiful majority. You may have seen her on YouTube. And have you signed up for Twitter? And are you tweeting? Welcome back, Joe Blundo. Great to have you here.
Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
We're at 614-292-8513. Your email is to openline at wosu.org. So you've left the 45 to 54-year-old age group and the status that came with it, you write, and you've been moved into the demographic category, as sometimes called near elderly, apparently. Huh?
Yeah, it happens overnight, you know, because the 45 to 54 age group, they still call them the young boomers, you know, young baby boomers.
Mm-hmm.
But so like midnight on April 17th, which was my birthday, all of a sudden, I'm not a young boomer anymore. So I went looking to see how I would be described. And one description I found was in a federal report, and that was near elderly.
It's a health insurance coverage of near elderly individuals aged 55 to 64.
It hurts.
Age is a big deal in our culture, isn't it? People don't like to tell their age. They, you know, people get upset around various birthdays. I don't know if maybe it's that way in every culture. I don't know.
I don't know, but and so also when you leave the 45 to 50-year-old age group is also supposedly your peak earning years. So, you know, so here I'm off peak and near elderly all of a sudden.
I heard somebody describe, they said about themselves, I'm on the upside of the power curve, meaning, you know, probably below 55. And then I guess there's a downside of the power curve.
I said I was on the young side of old, having turned 55.
So. Right. Well, you know, you've been writing about, and I think many of us know about Susan Boyle from Britain's Got Talent, this rather average-looking person, this woman who came out and just knocked him dead with this gorgeous voice. And over 70 million hits on YouTube have watched that 7 or so minutes from Britain's Got Talent. And she has this gorgeous voice. But you say, as a lifelong member of the People Who Aren't a Beautiful majority, I salute her success.
I salute her success, but I don't think she's the start of a trend. What I said in the column is there's like certain rules for when the not-so-beautiful get to be a star. And one way to do that is to do something that we associate only with the beautiful by TV and movie rules. So, for example, I use the example of Ruth Westheimer, you know, Dr. Ruth, the sex expert. Because in the movies and TV, only beautiful people get to have sex.
Sure.
But here you've got this diminutive older woman, you know, who has an encyclopedic knowledge of it. And so she stood out, you know.
So she's against type there. So she gets
against
to do
type.
That.
And so that gives her attention.
So Susan Boyle, again, you know, an average looking person. And normally if you're going to have a beautiful voice, we expect as a culture that you be male or female beautiful, right?
That's what TV demands. I don't know. I mean, I think we've gotten conditioned to that by TV. They demand it. You know, you just look at who wins American Idol.
Yeah.
When it's a woman especially, it's generally a pretty attractive woman that wins it. So.
And I think that the need to be attractive falls harder, at least in media culture, talking about media culture, on women than it does on men.
Oh, definitely. I made that point in the column that you can pair the frumpy husband with the beautiful wife in a sitcom, but never the other way around.
No.
Never do that.
That's almost a sitcom staple now, isn't it? The frumpy husband with the knockout wife.
Yeah, like according to Jim. Well, even the Flintstones. You know, Wilma in her day was pretty attractive, you know. Fred.
Is that a little strange? I think our culture is a little strange in this regard, that we have all these rules and expectations for how attractive somebody has to be to do this or that.
It's completely bizarre, but I think that's TV. I mean, TV is so sliced and diced and studied and, you know, run by – they know what brings ratings and it's all – so they know.
What does it say about us, though, the people who watch television? Oh,
we're wacky. We're a wacky culture. That's what it says.
You wrote about Susan Boyle. And by the way, if listeners, if you haven't seen that, just go to youtube.com. And if you don't know the internet very well, it's Y-O-U-T-U-B-E. And put in the name Susan Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, and just see her stunning performance. It's the first thing that comes up, the video from Britain's Got Talent. And you said an interesting thing about Susan Boyle because she's so average in appearance, so non-beautiful. You wrote, she wouldn't even be allowed to play a corpse on morgue porn such as CSI, the TV show.
Right. If you've noticed on those TV shows, the dead bodies are always – they tend to be young, attractive women, which I think is really terribly creepy. Those shows are creepy anyway, but I guess that's the point. But
it is creepy, isn't it? And I think you're right about that. You know, the corpses are these young, attractive women. And you call it morgue porn, and maybe that isn't too strong a term.
No, I think that's what it is. I mean, I mean, you turn the TV on. Here's a corpse, you know, with the chest light open.
Yeah,
and you just wonder why do we want to look at that?
Yeah. At what point do we say, well, this is amusing on one level, but at what point do we say this is nuts? beyond amusing.
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard about that case where the. A young woman was killed in a car accident, and somehow the photos of the aftermath got on the internet.
I heard about that. Yeah.
And people are, you know, thousands of hits on those photos, and the family, of course, is horrified, and they're afraid they're going to call up their daughter's name and see this picture.
Surely. So the internet has its pluses and minuses. Huh?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah. You wrote a little about the internet and about a study that found that 75% of 18 to 24-year-olds think that online content is geared toward them, 18 to 24. But in your age group, it's a little different.
Yeah, it was some small percentage, like 20%. We were right. It's not geared. It's really not geared to us, I don't think.
No?
No, I don't think so. With, you know, with all the celebrity websites and no, I think it's definitely geared to younger people.
Yeah. So you find yourself – do you find yourself using the internet much or are you a little alienated from it? Or?
Well, no, I use it constantly and that's because of my job. You know, so I'm always reading it and trying to see what people are talking about because that's what you want to be writing about, what people are talking about.
Sure.
And it's also such a tremendous fact-checking tool if you know where to go – if you go to the right place.
You got to be careful facts, there, don't you? Yeah.
You got to be very careful. But you know, I've gotten in this habit now where anytime I write a fact – if I have any doubt at all about it, any doubt whatsoever, I immediately go to the internet and look it up. I don't set it aside and say I'll check that later. I don't do anything like that. I immediately go and check it.
As you say, it's difficult to know where to check it. You know, Wikipedia, the big, you know, free online encyclopedia that, as they say, anybody can edit. Do you ever use that?
I use it in that it's a good starting place. Mm-hmm. If you want to because you can go to the end of those articles and look at their references, like their external references.
Yeah, you get their links, right?
And then usually those are the really authoritative sources,
sure.
So you can go there. You just have to be careful about it.
You do have to be careful. I do the same thing as you do. I start with Wikipedia and move from there because I was once looking up the bio of a journalist friend on Wikipedia and it had the bio. But it had a death date for him, but he's still alive.
Oh.
Somebody had put a death date in for him. So since anybody could edit, I went in there and took the death date out. And I phoned him and said, by the way, you better check the rest of your bio to make sure it's accurate too. But anybody at any moment can vandalize one of those sites and write anything they want about you.
Oh, sure they can. I find it interesting. You call up Columbus, Ohio on Wikipedia though. And that'll sort of give you an idea of its accuracy. It's actually pretty – I mean the article on Columbus, Ohio is very comprehensive and it's been debated back and forth. People are constantly revising it, changing it, questioning how accurate it is, changing little things. All in all, it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but you see constant – you can check the history of revisions and you see constant revisions.
Constant, yeah.
There was a science magazine called Nature and maybe about a year ago they had – prominent scientists take a look at science articles, both on Wikipedia and Encyclopedia Britannica online. And they found what they thought were 4 errors per article in terms of Wikipedia, but 3 for the Encyclopedia Britannica. And all those could be questioned and argued, I'm sure. So, it's a good starting point. Huh?
It is a good starting point, yeah. And that's what I use it for.
Well, what I'm afraid of with the Internet is that, people just look and they'll see something on a website, like a medical website, and take it as gospel without understanding, who is behind that website. You know, there's always that nice about us little click on a website to find out who's behind it. But even that can be deceptive sometimes.
It can be, yeah. You just have to be careful. But, about us is a great place to go when you're on a website, for sure.
Start number one, yeah. Columbus Dispatch columnist Joe Blunder with us, 614-292-8513. And have you got a Facebook page? You must.
I do have a Facebook. I just had to think for a minute. I do have a Facebook page that I think my daughter had something to do with getting it started. But so I have that, and I do have a Twitter thing. But the only reason I have it is because I wanted to write about it, because I was kind of baffled by the phenomenon. I still don't really get it, but I have a Twitter account.
So. Well, tell us about it. For those people who are not familiar with Twitter, tell us about Twitter.
Okay, well, it's a form of instant communication. You can write messages up to 140 characters long. So it's analogous to a text message on a cell phone. You can do it through your computer or through your cell phone. Mm-hmm. And then you can sign up to follow other people's Twitters, tweets.
They're called tweets.
Tweets, right.
Yeah.
So for example, I signed up to follow Barack Obama's tweets. Well, he doesn't tweet very much. Which is good. I think it's a good sign that our president doesn't tweet too much.
If he's got time to be tweeting, we've got a problem.
Yeah. But the funny thing is when you sign up to follow someone, then that person gets a message that says, like, Joe Blundo is following you on Twitter. So I follow you. So I got a message back saying Barack Obama is following you on Twitter. So I saved that one.
Which is not very likely.
I don't think it's very likely.
Following the millions of people who are following him. So – but all kinds of people – I've seen – 140 characters, tweets like, gee, I just had a ham sandwich and here at the University of California, I'm going off to take my physics exam and I feel rotten.
That's exactly what you get, 99% of it. And what I said in that column was if I were if I were a TV weatherman and I've got information to impart, I can tell you at least to bring a coat, to bring an umbrella. What am I going to tell people, every 90 seconds or every half hour? However often you want to tweet, what am I going to tell them?
So you got a Twitter account.
I haven't
tweeted yet.
I have not tweeted.
But you said that you had fans anyway.
Within like a day, I had, maybe half a dozen people were following me on Twitter. And what I said in the column was, I guess they're fans of brooding silences because I haven't said much.
There's nothing that much that you've said. Can you imagine something that you'd like to say on Twitter?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, what they tell you in journalism school is you carefully deliberate everything you write. Everything's very deliberate. And you don't write the first thing that comes into your head. But the way these forms of communication, that's exactly what it is. It's all off the top of your head. It's taken me a while to get used to it.
I think every once in a while you come across a Twitterer who is tweeting interesting information. Like they have a category, like they are a political scientist, and they'll say, go to this link to see Barack Obama's press conference now, or here's an interesting article about the war in Afghanistan. Here's the link. In other words, you could have informative Twitters. 140 characters let you do a fair number of things.
You could, yes. And there's some people who are really good at it, but not me.
Not you. No. By the way, if you Twitter, we'd like to hear from you. And if you think the information if you have a lot of followers, and 614-292-8513, you could email your comments to openline@wosu.org. Now, Joe, I want to know more about – I signed up for Facebook and started a page, and then I decided – I didn't want all these Facebook friends, so I shut it down. Somebody said to me, if you had a – because you're on the radio, if you had a Facebook page, you could have 1,000 friends. I don't want 1,000 friends.
Right.
What do you mean friends? So tell us how Facebook works and what would we find if we go to Joe Blundo's Facebook page?
Oh, you'd find a brief profile, again, mostly done by my daughter, who she's sort of my Facebook consultant, so she gave me some advice on how to do it, and a photo of me and actually and of her too. And then, people can write on your – they can send messages. It's called writing on your wall. So they'll send you little messages. And And you can keep up with what people are doing and look at their lists of friends. And it's, I mean, it's very useful. You can invite people to parties and things like that. Mm-hmm. And
you can keep in touch with people around the country.
Yeah, it's a good way of keeping in touch. Sure, you know, for if you have a family, say you're planning a family reunion, you can set up a Facebook page for a family reunion. Mm-hmm. And then all your relatives could go there, and that's a good way to communicate the information.
And put up the photos from and you from the reunion. And you could keep, for example, you could keep in touch with other columnists. I could keep in touch with other talk show hosts. Yeah.
Right.
So something to that.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like a 55-year-old on this topic. You know, it's I'm not against Facebook. Okay. Twitter, I just don't get it.
Phil, you've got a comment about Twitter, huh?
Yeah. I just wanted to add a little bit to the discussion. I think it's right that it can be a stream of banalities if you allow it to be. But I was reading an interesting blog the other day about Twitter, because I've been skeptical of it as well. And the gentleman writing the blog was just pointing out that, look, if all you're getting in your Twitter account, if the only tweets you're receiving are just endless banalities, that's really as much your fault as it is the people that you're following. He was making the point that he uses his Twitter account as a filter for the abundance of information that's on the internet. And so by friending or following the right people who are interested in the things he's interested in, like art, anthropology, technology, essentially those people are performing a service. They're filtering all this, the immense amount of information that's thrown at us every day, filtering that for him and providing him with links and other sources of information that allow him to digest all this information more effectively. And I thought that was really interesting and made me reconsider the utility of Twitter.
Yeah, that is very interesting. In other words, he's picking people to follow who, let's say if he's interested in art, who are giving him links and other pieces of information that he wants to know that are important to him. But how does he find those people?
That's a question that's sort of beyond me, because I have yet to really delve into the realm of Twitter. I would suspect I'm on Facebook, and for me it's been kind of a process of elimination. You know, it starts with people that you're friends with, and then you can kind of branch out into the community beyond that. And I suspect it's similar in Twitter. You become friends with a few like-minded people, and then you sort of look at who they're friends with or who they're following, and you start to look at whose tweets are more useful to you. And
sure.
Although, you know, that's also time consuming. So,
yeah, really. Well, Phil, that's an interesting effective use of the medium. Thanks so much for calling.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Joe, because it's very funny. I thought you wrote, "In what sort of hell would you be subjected to the passing thoughts of not only Martha Stewart and Mark Dan, but also car dealerships and a building under construction? That hell would be called Twitter."
Yeah, because products can tweet and buildings can tweet. And so Pabst Blue Ribbon will send you tweets about where it's on sale for $2 a glass.
Now, there you go. That is
useful information, right?
But Martha Stewart is tweeting. Huh?
Yeah, she tweets. And it'll be like, you know, what's going to be on her show, or, you know, what she did on her show and so forth. I did run across one tweet from Mark Dan. Now, again, if it really is Mark Dan, who knows?
The former Attorney General. We don't know.
Right. It was something about a volleyball game one of his kids was playing in. So
could have been another Mark Dan.
Could have been another Mark Dan. There's 8 Pope Benedicts on Twitter.
So. Right. Yeah. Well, somebody could impersonate you. Couldn't they become Joe Blundo on Twitter? And
they could. And I wish somebody would, actually. That might be a good column.
Yeah. Well, you wrote a column a while back. You said – it was an annual column on things you are tired of. And you hadn't written in a while because you were tired of writing that particular column, which made sense to me. But there are some things you're really tired of.
Yes, the penny.
Yeah.
You know, the filthy little copper disc. And, you know, I still hear people say, well, I still pick up pennies when I see them. I think, well, why? You know, why not pick up a used syringe? I mean, it's worth about the same thing.
So you don't – if you see a penny on the ground, you don't pick it up?
No.
I don't either. What would you pick up, a nickel?
I suppose I'd pick up a nickel.
That's the cutoff point.
I guess that's the cutoff. But even that, you know, you have to wonder, are your vertebrae not worth more than, you know, just to bend over, you know, pick up a nickel? I don't know.
And you said filthy penny. They do tend to be dirty.
Dirty and, you know, they're just not worth anything. And it costs more to make them than they're worth. And, you just wonder, why do we put up with this inefficiency? And even Lincoln, wouldn't Lincoln say, look, do I really want my face on a worthless coin? No, get rid of it.
Yeah. But what do you think pennies tend to be filthier than nickels and dimes and quarters?
Oh, probably not. Maybe because we throw them away. We throw them away. That's why they're.
But here's the thing. If we get rid of the pennies, then every time there's a sales tax increase, it's got to be a nickel.
True.
Maybe.
And I've heard that objection.
Yeah,
that is true.
What else do you tired of?
Oh, let's see. I'm tired of.
You're tired of the first 100 days measurement.
Oh, the first 100 days of a president's term. You know, that's just such an arbitrary period. It never made any sense to me. I think it started with FDR and then Roosevelt.
You know, Ken Rudin, the political affairs editor, is coming up from NPR next. I'm going to ask him why we do this 100 days. Yeah.
Yeah, tell him we ought to cut it out. Let's give the guy 200 days, okay? Yeah. At least 200 days.
Get something decent accomplished. Yeah. You know what I'm tired of? Swine flu. Because there's some vital information, and it's been horrible because some people have died from it and some people have gotten very sick. But what I'm tired of is the media approach to swine flu, in which everything is, look out, here it comes, and oh, please.
Right. It's a tough call because when you've got something like that and you don't know exactly what it is, you tend to err on the side of over-informing, I think.
But I think the reason the media overinforms on something like that is, number one, it's easier to cover. It's easy to cover.
Right.
It doesn't require a lot of work. Secondly, it sells television newscasts. And, Amy Jurevich, our line producer, noted that swine flu happened during the ratings sweeps week. That says something, doesn't it? Yeah, you get more people watching your television newscast or maybe buying your newspaper, right?
Yeah, well, we don't have sweeps week in the newspaper. But
no, that's true. But you have sweeps week every day.
Right. Yeah, sort of every day is sweeps week. Yeah, especially now. I have a column coming out on it's actually more on language, but I mentioned that the swine flu, eventually we'll get around to a better term for that, I think. Science will come
is
up with
it. H1N1?
H1N1 is the name of the virus,
yeah.
Or something, yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
And people will say it because they trust scientists. You know, scientists tend to clarify things.
So. Yeah. So you also mentioned you were tired of the Senate race in Minnesota, Al Franken versus Norm Coleman.
Oh, when is that going to end? I mean,
seems.
It's been – well, it's been more than 100 days. There we go. You know,
yeah,
it just goes on. What did I say? I said it was a drama without resolution, and it makes it tedious, like the show Lost. You know, there's never any resolution.
Yeah, right.
Similar to that.
Columbus Dispatch columnist Joe Blundo, 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. Now, you did write a column a little while back about one of our WOSU television pledge drives.
Ah, so I did.
And I'm sure there's another one coming up. we can confidently say that. And there will be on radio this week. You said, begone, Susie Orman, get lost, Dr. Wayne Dyer, go away, Yanni.
Right. And I actually, what I wanted to – I didn't understand why they repeat those shows during the pledge drive over and over. So I thought, well, there's got to be a reason because there's too much at stake here. So I kind of did a little research and found a research company that actually studies what works and what doesn't in pledge drives. And so they had reasons. So there are reasons.
And tell me, what are those reasons?
The shows that they endlessly rebroadcast bring in more money than a show like Frontline or Nature or the ones I like to watch.
Sure. Yanni brings in more money than Frontline.
Yanni does bring in more money.
Or Nature. That's right.
And
it's sad to say in a way, but he does.
And one thing the researcher said was that you really don't want a show that people get wrapped up in. You know, like a Frontline episode, it grips you. You want to, you know, so you don't go to the phone and call, right? Whereas Yanni,
sure.
You know, in between songs, she'll go, I guess, and that's the theory, and it must work.
It makes sense. I mean, when you think about it, that a show that is really gripping and that may be on a subject that may be, you know, a little difficult to hear sometimes, I mean, global warming or something like that, wouldn't stimulate you to go to the phone, I would think.
No, but so what a strange system. You've got this audience that likes, that gets used to shows like Frontline and Nature and This Old House and so forth, but when you need to raise money, you have to sort of shove them aside and go after people who like Yanni and Susie Orman and Wayne Dyer and the Celtic women. So,
are you reconciled to the fundraisers? Are you happy about them?
Well, I'm reconciled to them in the fact that if they keep public broadcasting around, then I'm all for it because I'm a huge fan of it. So
yeah.
I want it to stay. So if that's what has to happen, that's what has to happen.
Okay. And Dennis is here. Hello, Dennis.
Thank you. Joel, I have a question for you. You might not have an answer.
Okay.
I was featured on the front page of the Dispatch October 13th and October 18th, a story by Jeb Phillips on disabled veterans.
Uh-huh.
I am a disabled veteran that the VA finally gave into for Agent Orange. The problem is bigger than you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And I just came back from my 40th year reunion from Vietnam and was approached by other people in Ohio who have the same credentials and awards that I do. They've been denied. I have been approved, and the VA won't answer why. Does it sound like a good story to you?
Potentially, yes. It does sound like a good story.
Then I am going to send you the information. Feel free to contact Jeb Phillips about me.
Okay.
And thank you for your answer.
Dennis, thanks. Thanks for your call. You also wrote, Joe, the Ohio Historical Society is contemplating some big cuts, and maybe some of the sites that would normally be open might not be able to be open anymore. So you had some suggestions along these lines. You said, if we can't have the Neil Armstrong Air and Space Museum open in Wapakoneta, we've always got the Ohio Quarter.
Right, which has Neil Armstrong on it.
Yeah.
And what was the other one? Instead of the Warren G. Instead of Harding's house.
Up in Marion, huh?
Oh, yeah. Marion Harding High School, I guess I said.
You always visit Marion Harding High School.
Yeah.
You said instead of going to the Newark Earthworks, if they have to close, you can always visit the Franklin County Landfill.
Right. I guess that's an example of I think the best humor columns have some anger or some passion behind them, some feeling behind them. And not.
Yeah.
I was trying to express my dismay at what's happening to these historical sites.
It is a shame, isn't it? I mean, the Ohio Historical Society actually has to undergo budget cuts, or may potentially be facing budget cuts that could result in the closing of some of those places.
Could, yes. And I mean, they're working very hard to avoid that, but just the fact that it could happen, I think.
So you're the Langry about that.
Yeah. I mean, Neil Armstrong, how could you – how many states have a Neil Armstrong that they can call their own? How could you close his museum? You know, it's terrible. There's a story in the paper, I think, this morning about another effort to keep it open, a possibility of teaming up with another organization to keep it open. So I hope that happens.
And you said also if the National Road Zane Grey Museum in Norwich closes, you can always go to the Cracker Barrel Restaurant in Zanesville.
Yeah, they have antiques on the wall. They have historical stuff on the wall, so you can consider
yeah, you could.
You want to consider it.
Zane Grey, his family was from Zanesville. That's Zane Grey, the Western writer from the early 20th century. And although I understand the real Zane Grey Museum is where he actually worked. He moved to a small town in Pennsylvania, which is where he is buried. And he sold 40 million books in his time. I don't know if anybody reads Zane Grey anymore, although I happen to be reading a Zane Grey novel.
Oh, right, are
you? Yeah. Very, very interesting. And well, instead of the Ohio River Museum in Marietta, you suggest we visit the Ohio River in Marietta.
The Ohio River, right.
And meanwhile, we just have a minute left. The casino weasels are stalking us again. The casino weasels. You're for issuing a temporary restraining order, huh?
Oh, they really bug me, those people. And you know what I really hate? They use that word gaming instead of gambling.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, if you want to have gaming here, make it be video gaming, and 12-year-old boys will clean you out in a week, you know. Don't call it gaming. I hate that term.
So do you think that they should just go away, or –
I wish they – they're not going to go away.
No.
We need – the state needs some way of dealing with them. Probably the state needs to come up with its own proposal for gambling and so that we get a better deal than they're going to give us.
And they're talking about that in the Ohio legislature, are they not? You know,
I think they are. I hope they are, because I think it's probably inevitable that it's coming. So we might as well get a deal out of it. Yeah.
If they come, will you go?
I'm not too interested in gambling.
Not very interested.
Yeah, not too interested. I've done it, but it's just – I don't know. I don't find it all that interesting. So.
Yeah. Well, Joe, the Columbus Dispatch columnist Joe Blundo with us. Joe, as always, we'll look forward to your columns and stories in the Dispatch. And
thank you, Fred.
Thanks for being with us over the years, and thanks for coming today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And when we come back, we'll discuss the Washington political scene with National Public Radio's political editor and political junkie Ken Rudin, joining us. Lots of issues in Washington this week. On listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.